Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's my pleasure to introduce to you for our today's program is Food Addiction 2.0. The original food addiction program was in 2012 with the same panelists, so it will be fascinating to hear the updates from the last 4 years. So Dr. Stice, and just raise your hand, so there we go, served as assistant professor and associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin and subsequently took a position as senior research scientist at Oregon Research Institute. His research focuses on identifying risk factors that predict onset of eating disorders, obesity, substance abuse, and depression, and on designing and disseminating prevention and treatment interventions for these public health problems. He also developed a dissonance-based body acceptance / eating disorder prevention program that has been implemented with over 3.5 million young girls in 116 countries. He received a career award from the National Institutes of Health, a distinguished scientific award for early contributions to psychopathology from the American Psychological Association, the Nan Tobler Award from the Society for Prevention Research, and the Laurie Irving Award for Excellence in Eating Disorder Prevention and Awareness from the National Eating Disorders Association. Dr. Nicole Avina is a research psychologist and neuroscientist who is an expert in the fields of nutrition, diet, and addiction. She received a PhD in psychology and neuroscience from Princeton University in 2006, followed by a postdoctoral fellowship at Rockefeller University. Dr. Avina presently holds a faculty position at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. She has published over 70 scholarly journal articles on topics related to diet, nutrition, and overeating. Her research achievements have been honored by awards from groups including the New York Academy of Sciences, the American Psychological Association, and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Dr. Avina's new book, What to Eat When You're Pregnant, provides a comprehensive guide for women on what nutrients are key during pregnancy and what foods you can eat to obtain them to ensure healthy weight gain for you and healthy development for your baby. Dr. Avina's other book, Why Diets Fail, reviews the research on food addiction and provides tips on way in which people can remove added sugars and carbohydrates from their diet. Dr. Avina has a blog on Psychology Today. Dr. Vera Tarman, MD, Vera, there's a lot of initials after your names. I apologize. It's all very impressive. I don't know what all the initials are, so we will go into that. But MD and many other things is the medical director of Renaissance, Canada's largest drug and alcohol treatment center. She has spoken internationally at workshops, lectures, and conferences on the subject of food addiction. She was co-host and regular contributor of two additional programs on local TV, Addictions Unplugged and Living Clean, Living Well in 2012 to 2014, and will also be hosting her own show, Toronto Speaks Addiction, in the fall of 2015. She's an expert blogger on food addiction for addiction.com and has written numerous posts and spoken to media with the intent to educate the public about food addiction. Dr. Tarman is currently helping design and oversee Renaissance pilot program on food addiction that did open its doors in November 2014. She is the author of Food Junkies, The Truth About Food Addiction. Michael Prager is a member of the journalism diaspora, having written and edited daily newspapers for 30 years until he accepted a buyout from the Boston Globe in 2007. Since then, he's published two books, 2010's Fat Boy, Thin Man, and this year's Sustainable You, and has become sought after as a speaker on both topics as well. He's just returned from presenting as the only non-Israeli at TEDx Eilat, And he regularly presents at resort spas before industry associations and corporate groups and at treatment and recovery focused events. Michael also operates a burgeoning coaching practice in which he and his clients collaborate toward their holistic personal change. He is the proud dad of Joseph, age 6, and the grateful spouse of Georgina, no age given. They are living happily ever after in Arlington, Massachusetts. Okay. Sorry, turn the page. Robert Lustig is a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and a member of the Institute of Health Policy Studies at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Lustig is a neuroendocrinologist whose research focuses on the regulation of energy balance by the central nervous system. He is currently investigating the contribution of nutritional, neural, hormonal, and genetic influences in the expression of the current obesity epidemic and diabetes both in children and adults. Dr. Lustig, graduated from MIT in 1976 and received his MD from Cornell University Medical College in 1980. He has his Master's of Studies of Law from Hastings College of Law in 2013. He's the author of many articles, chapters, and reviews on childhood obesity, including the academic volume Obesity Before Birth and the popular books Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease, and the Fat Chance Cookbook. He is also president of the Institute for Responsible Nutrition, a nonprofit dedicated to eradicating childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. Alyssa Appel, PhD, is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. She is director of the Aging, Metabolism, and Emotions Lab and the Center for Obesity Assessment, Study, and Treatment, COAST is the acronym, associate director of the Center for Health and Community, and associate director of the NIH-funded UCSF Nutrition and Obesity Research Center. She studies psychological, social, and behavioral processes related to chronic psychological stress with a focus on overeating and cell aging. Through her research on stress and early training in the Yale Center for Eating and Weight Disorders, she became interested in the intricate relationships between chronic psychological stress, compulsive eating behavior, and energy balance. With her collaborators, she is conducting clinical trials to examine the effect of self-regulation and mindfulness training programs on compulsive eating, weight, including during pregnancy. And she leads or co-leads studies funded by the NIA and NHLBA, including a stress measurement network and a multi-campus center on obesity funded by the UC Office of the President. Appel studied psychology and psychobiology at Stanford University in BA in 1990 and clinical and health psychology at Yale University, PhD, in 1998. She has received several awards, including the APA Early Career Award and Academy of Behavioral Medicine Research Neil Miller Young Investigator Award. Well, how about a big round of applause for all they've done, right? Okay, so now we will begin with our questions. So, Michael, as the author of Fat Boy, Thin Man, would you please chronicle your own path of food addiction? When did you know or suspect that you were a food addict?
I got the idea that I might be a food addict from a therapist that I was seeing. His name's Bob Deutsch, practices in West Hartford, Connecticut, and he had such a big influence on my life that he's in mention of both my books, and whenever I have a public forum, I like to mention him in gratitude. However, it was not at all good news to me when he suggested that I might be a food addict. There was plenty of evidence that might suggest that. I was, in my first 30 years, I topped 300 pounds 3 different times. I had lost more than 350 pounds. And yet, by 33, I weighed 365. Now, if you do the math quickly, that's 715 pounds, but I didn't weigh that. I gained and lost weight repeatedly, like most dieters do. So in the first 30 years of my life, I thought that I knew what the problem was, just like most people, I think they know. If they're overweight, go on a diet. And while I focused on dieting, I was a fabulous dieter. Who else do you know? I mean, it's a checkered accomplishment, but who else do you know who's lost hundreds and hundreds of pounds? But it was never an effective strategy to change my life. And then through a process that I could never have designed, because I'm not smart enough, I started doing something different, triggered by Bob Deutsch, and engaging. I went to rehab for food. In October 1991, I checked in, as I said, at 365. And I was there for 9 weeks, and it did make a very big difference in my life. But even that, in my opinion, reflecting on my experience, would not have been enough to change the path I was on. Among the other things that happened to me around that time, as I said, this path that I couldn't have designed, was I became more involved in communities, support groups, group therapy, all these kinds of things. And so when I said that dieting didn't work for me, it isn't that I didn't need to change the way I ate. But my experience, my very strong experience, was that I had to do a lot more than just change the way I ate. And when I did the broad range of those things, my life transformed. I imagine that bell means something, so I'm going to shut up.
I don't know what that bell meant. So, no, not that I know of. So I'm sure it won't go off again. I don't have any idea.
Oh, well,
it's
really
a panel, not a debate.
That's right. Yeah.
So I'll just complete my answer then by saying that in addition to losing 155 pounds and keeping it off for 25 years, and of course I always say, of those two numbers, 155 and 25, 25 is much bigger. Some other things have happened. And again, if I had planned it all out that this was how I was going to transform my life, it never would have gone like this. But also in the time since 1991, I finally got my first girlfriend. I was 36 years old. It was 3 years after rehab. I thought that I couldn't get a date because I was fat. And while, of course, it wasn't helpful, it was by no means the reason that I couldn't do that. So I got my first girlfriend at 36. I got married at 46 to Georgina. Became a dad at 52. I became a section editor at the Boston Globe, where it was the first newspaper that ever put me in charge of a section and was by far the biggest newspaper of the five that I'd worked at. And I've published two books. And I didn't plan any of that. So it wasn't just that I lost the weight and kept it off. My life has blossomed and transformed as a result of coming to think that I might be a food addict. Well, first, that food addiction might exist, that I might be one, and then I might benefit from acting as if I was a food addict. We may get to the question today, does food addiction exist? And to me, that's an important question, but it's also not the important question. What happened for me is that I started acting like I was one, and my life transformed. If it turns out I wasn't one because it doesn't exist, my life still transformed. And that's what was important to me. Thanks.
Perfect. Thank you, Michael. Dr. Avina, would you please define food addiction for us in general terms?
Sure. So I guess as a foray to kind of introducing that, I'd like to sort of give my story and how I kind of got into this field as well, because I think it kind of plays into how we define food addiction, how we're presently thinking about it. So back when I was a little girl, 15 years ago, when I started graduate school, I was working with a gentleman named Bart Hobel. And we had been sort of talking about some ideas of what I might work on for my dissertation. And one of the things that came up and had sort of been on his mind had been this whole idea that maybe we're having such a crisis with people having problems losing weight and this crisis of obesity because people maybe become addicted to food, just like how people become addicted to drugs or alcohol. We have so many different types of foods in our food supply these days, you know, processed foods, foods that are laden with added fats and sugars. Food is very different than it was 50 years ago. Maybe that somehow has something to do with why people are overweight and can't control their body weight. So I thought that was a really cool and interesting idea. And so we started looking at the literature, and it turned out that there were lots of people out there like Michael who had been talking about this idea that they were addicted to food and that, you know, they treated it as an addiction, and then they were able to lose weight and maintain a healthy lifestyle. But interestingly, there weren't really any scientific studies on this. There weren't any empirically based experiments that had been conducted to try to understand whether or not this was a real phenomenon, other than this anecdotal accounts that we had from people like Michael. So that's kind of where I got into this. And so I started to develop with Dr. Hobel, who's since deceased, an animal model to try to understand whether or not food could be addictive. And one of the reasons why we focus on animal models was because we can really control the variables with our lab rats, and they don't have, you know, hang-ups about whether or not they look good in a bikini or social pressures to, you know, conform to what the ideal is in society at that given moment. So what we did was we started to take the criteria used to define an addiction to things like drugs or alcohol. And we developed studies to see whether or not rats would do those behaviors and show those behavioral changes in the brain in response to foods, in response to highly palatable foods that many people find difficult to control their intake of. And so in terms of how we define food addiction, that's how it began. And I think that's how many scientists and medical professionals are considering, if we're going to talk about food as an addictive substance, what are we going to look for? So things that we would look for would be, do the animals or people in many cases show signs of binging? Do they show signs of tolerance, craving, withdrawal? There are diagnostic criteria that are used to define addiction to drugs and alcohol. And so what scientists have been doing is to basically take those criteria and say, well, do we see this happening with food? And so that's really, I think, where the studies are presently, is trying to see whether or not we can identify aspects of addiction like we would see with drugs and alcohol, but when the substance of abuse happens to be a food.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Tarman, does the American Medical Association or the American Psychological Association recognize food addiction as a disease or a psychiatric disorder?
Thank you. I'm going to take Dr. Avina's lead and give a little bit of history myself because it really fits very nicely. When I started working in the addiction field, so one of my letters is I belong to the American Society of Addiction Medicine, I became really aware working clinically with addicts that people, when they stopped using their, I mean, I would see people coming into treatment, so they're stopping their alcohol use, their cocaine use, their crystal meth use, their whatever it is, and pick up food. And they would say to me, I can't understand why I'm eating the way I used to use my drug. And in some cases would say, I'd rather go back to my drug. I then started to see those colored glasses to look at, I started to see the same behaviors in the regular population, not everywhere, but when I did. And again, it mimicked the same pattern. And I spoke about this a number of times, and it wasn't until I came across the journal, which was actually your work, I think it was in 2008 was one of your first publications, that I looked at that and I said, finally, I have research that will support what I've been clinically experiencing. Then I started to talk about it. And you're absolutely right. We're still at that preclinical stage. And we're unfortunately in the middle of a sort of gray area where we've got the preclinical work. No clinical research yet. I think you're actually starting that. But now, as a clinician, I can't wait until that research. So we've actually launched into doing some clinical work on the premise of just basically using the DSM-5 criteria of food addiction. So your question about Psychiatric Association or Psychological Association acknowledge food addiction? No, it does not. At this stage in the game, it's understood intuitively. People will say, yeah, food is addictive, but we don't actually have a clinical diagnosis yet. And when the DSM-5 was under its debates about what would be accepted and what wouldn't be, we got stuck with the prove that it's not an eating disorder. And that's actually one of our conversations that it's going to be. But as clinicians, as I said, we have to move on and work with this. But the problem with that, I'll just end with this, is until it's a diagnosis, we won't have the appropriate research, clinical research funded. I don't know how you're going to get your stuff funded, nor will we have the medication or the insurance programs to support programs that we need. So it's a political issue that it ought to be recognized, and it isn't yet.
Thank you. Dr. Lustig, what are the components of processed food that might be addictive?
Well, first of all, let me start out. This is not a debate, but I am going to play the woman's card because I just want to point out that all three men were dressed in purple today, and clearly the women did not get the memo. So this is actually a very complicated question because there are so many different things in our food supply. There are many things that are considered food. But the thing that people have really sort of targeted is this thing called fast food. So is fast food addictive? Well, what is fast food? You know, Michael Moss wrote a very extensive book, and the title of the book, I'm sure you know, is Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Industry Hooked Us, right? Well, he left one out. There's one more thing in fast food, caffeine. So that's our panoply of agents that we have to look at: salt, sugar, fat, and caffeine. So I want to take those very quickly in order. Salt. Is salt addictive? Turns out, no. It's habituating, but it's not addictive because we have patients that we take care of. I'm a pediatric endocrinologist. We have patients with congenital adrenal hyperplasia, salt-losing variety, who are losing salt like crazy. They're consuming salt like wildfire. They're drinking the pickle brine right out of the pickle jar because their kidneys can't hold on to salt because they're missing the hormone that retains it. And as soon as you replace that hormone, these behaviors go away. So it is physiologically driven, but it is clearly not addiction in the sense that it's not, doesn't have a supertentorial component. How about fat? So is fat addictive? People say, well, fat's addictive. Well, if that were the case, then every Atkins dieter would actually get worse rather than better. And most of the Atkins dieters who are successful, and the reason they're successful is because fat is not addictive. Now, there are seven classes of fat. There's omega-3s, there's monounsaturates, there's polyunsaturates, there's saturated fat, there's medium-chain triglycerides, there's omega-6s, and there's trans fats. And they may have specific and different phenomena that go along with it, but there are no data to suggest that any given one of those is addictive by itself. It can increase mouthfeel, it can make certain foods much more pleasurable, it may increase the salience of specific foods, like, for instance, milk chocolate, but it is not addictive per se. Then we get to caffeine. Caffeine, everyone knows, is addictive, okay? And I am addict number one, okay? And I am very clear on this, and my wife as well. We are two codependents with the Krupps, all right? That is just, and if you take my Starbucks away from me, I will kill you. Caffeine meets all of the criteria for addiction. But it's not toxic. As far as we know, other than mixing caffeine with alcohol, which we call Four Loko, which is now banned, caffeine is, for the most part, relatively benign unless you take many five-hour energy pills and get an arrhythmia. So caffeine is addictive, but it is not toxic, and we allow it, and you can go buy it at the corner Starbucks. So that leaves the last one, sugar. So is sugar addictive? And the answer is the person immediately to my right, Nicole Avena, has done the primary work that has answered this question, certainly in animals. So there are four criteria for addiction in animals: binging, withdrawal, craving, and cross-sensitization with other drugs of abuse, meaning you addict an animal to one drug over 21 days, then expose them to a second drug they've never seen before, they're addicted to that one too. Sugar meets all four criteria within animals. Now, what about humans? So, for humans, the criteria for addiction has changed very recently because we had the DSM-4, and now we have the DSM-5. Now, according to the DSM-4 criteria, sugar did not meet the criteria because you need tolerance and withdrawal. But now with the DSM-5 criteria, it's tolerance and a whole host of line items that basically amount to dependence.
Rob, explain what DS,
Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that the American Psychological Association sets up as the laws of psychiatry. And so the laws for or the rules for addiction have changed. And according to the DSM-5 criteria, sugar is addictive. So we have the data mechanistically in animals. We have the correlative data in humans. And we certainly see this empirically in our patients. And when we get people off sugar, and they do have a withdrawal period, usually lasts 4 or 5 days, but we can actually get them off. And we just did a study where we took kids off sugar and substituted starch for 10 days. They all had a period where they felt really lousy, and then they came out from under it, and they all felt way better. And I can't tell you that that was addiction, or I can't tell you if that was basically withdrawal from caffeine, since most of them were soda drinkers. Maybe they were withdrawing off both. You know, this is part of the problem also, is trying to figure out what is the addictive substance, and what if you have two addictive substances? That's called a soda. We don't have the data for that yet, but we certainly have biochemical preclinical data that says sugar is addictive. So sugar and caffeine are the two items in our diet that have addictive properties.
Thank you.
Patty, could I just say something just to speak to that point? Because I think this introduces an important sort of, I think, concept that we need to think about when talking about this idea of food as an addictive substance. So right now, when we think of a food, we have everything under the umbrella of carrots to Pop-Tarts. Mm-hmm. That's food. They're all food. And so one of the things that, you know, Rob has been talking about is these different ingredients that are associated with foods. And I think part of the issue in terms of from a research standpoint and eventually from a treatment standpoint is, well, you know, we can think about these ingredients singularly and what they might do to the brain and behavior, but most of us eat these ingredients in combination. And so if you wanted to, I just thought of a really good example, the a salted caramel latte would have all four of those substances in it and is a quite a delicious item. So I think when we're thinking about this whole idea of, you know, foods as addictive substances, one question that I often get posed is, you know, well, which foods are addictive? What is it about those foods that are addictive? And when we think about the foods that people typically eat, they are combinations of these different ingredients plus other additives and chemicals and ingredients that go into creating the foods that, you know, sustain us. So I do think that these are kind of elements that we need to think about when considering what is it about the food that we eat that's addictive.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Stice, what are the similarities between how eating palatable foods and taking drugs affects our brains?
So pretty much, you know, a gigantic part of our brain is devoted towards kind of reward learning, et cetera. And when you consume a palatable food, high sugar, high fat food, it activates kind of the key reward regions, which I think of as the striatum. There's a whole bunch of other little parts near it, but it causes dopamine signaling in those same regions, and it's the same exact thing that happens with any drugs that we abuse. They all basically perpetuate dopamine signaling. So it's very similar. There are two important differences, and I like to kind of get those out there just because if people want a perfect parallel, the parallel isn't perfect. But when you consume drugs, they artificially prolong dopamine signaling, essentially. Like cocaine leaves dopamine in the synaptic cleft longer, the box reuptake process. So there's that part of it, that when you eat food, there's nothing that's artificially prolonging dopamine signaling. But what you do have is that you have a lot of sort of gut peptide and hormone feedback that sort of also stimulates this. So you can inject fat or sugar directly into your gut, bypassing your mouth and the whole eating, you know, oral sensory process, and you still get dopamine release from that. So in some ways, food is actually better at causing dopamine release, but they're not the exact same thing.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Tarman, let me see if this you're supposed to. No, Dr. Appel, excuse me. Is there a connection between our brain chemistry, stress, and food addiction?
So I'm going to ask you all to answer that in your head first. So does stress increase our wanting for certain foods? Most of you probably said yes. But what I'm going to answer this question both thinking about what we know from population studies of thousands of people and then close up what happens when We look at individuals' brain under magnet when we can visualize what's happening with their neurotransmitters and their brain activity. So what do we know about stress in hundreds of thousands of people and eating and weight? Well, actually, what we know is that stress causes weight gain, but also weight loss. So the quick answer to your question, what's the relationship between stress, eating, and the neurochemistry, is yes, there is a relationship, but it's complex and it's layered. So now we're starting to unpack that and understand that relationship more. So why is it that some people with years of chronic work stress become obese and others actually lose weight over the same 10 years? So what we know a little bit about that. What determines those differences? One is, and I'm going to summarize across probably 10 different studies, so rather than tell you about different studies, here's the story of what we've learned. So when we look at people under chronic stress, those who are obese also have a lot of cravings. They're much more prone to cravings, so they're having high reward activity, and it explains their obesity under chronic stress. And when we look at those in those huge studies, why is it that some people have lost weight and some people have gained? We know that the people who have gained weight started off as overeaters. They started off as having a bit of a higher BMI. They're already prone to that. And then under stress, then they blossom. Then the reward, there are longer term changes, we think, in the reward areas of the brain. So if we look inside, what's happening to the brain under stress? We know several things. And so, for example, if you look at the brain of people with obesity versus people who are lean under emotional stress, you see more dramatic cortical limbic striatal activity, so kind of the emotion reward center activity under stress in the people with obesity. And what else happens while they're being stressed? Cravings and hunger go up. Instead of going down, having a shutdown stress response, they actually crave palatable food. So they're having a different stress response, and it's more primed to overeat. So that is how we can understand why people are different, and some people have this altered neurochemistry, and under stress, they're going to want more highly palatable food, not less. Now, what else have we learned about who those people are? Who are those vulnerable people who have that reward response under stress? There's another set of studies. This is by Jens Prusner and colleagues. And when they look at people, they've done a PET scan, so they're not just looking at blood flow in the brain. They're actually seeing what's happening with dopamine activity in the reward area. And under stress, they have found that their dopamine goes up in the reward area, but not in everyone. It goes up more in people who've been exposed to more stress, and not any kind of stress. Early life stress is particularly important. So that's a vulnerability factor. We already know that at a population level, that's a risk factor for obesity and eating disorders. But now we also know it's changing the reward circuitry. It appears to be priming the brain for more of an addictive eating pattern. So that's the neurochemistry, that we know that people are different and that there are certain people who respond to stress, more people than not, with this craving for highly palatable foods. And then we've been talking about what is it about food and what type of food might wreak havoc on the brain. So let's add sugar to this picture. What happens when you have stress and sugar mixed together? In the rodents, they develop more of the metabolic syndrome and over binge eating. And in people, this is harder to study because we can't put people on high sugar diets and look at causality. But we did do an experiment with our colleagues at UC Davis, Kevin Lugero, and Kimber Stanhope, and looked at what happens in the brain when not just we know that stress can create this craving for sugar, but what about if you put the other direction? If you put people on a high sugar diet, what is that doing to their stress response? It turns out that the arrow goes both ways. So if you put people under high sugar diet for 2 weeks and you stress them out at the beginning and you stress them out at the end, their stress response has been changed. Now just in your head, has it gone up or down? So in this acute model with healthy people, sugar is dampening the stress response. It's calming the brain. So at baseline, both groups, uh, the the fake sugar group and the sucrose group, everyone has the same stress response before they've started their sugar diet. They go up in cortisol and they have the same neural response. And then 2 weeks later, the group that has been feasting on sugar has a dampened neural stress response and a dampened physiological stress response. Their cortisol is blunted. So this gives us another clue that it's not just that stress can make us prone to hedonic drive and overeating and binge eating, but that once we're feeding on sugar, regardless of stress, we're altering our stress response. We're causing a comfort food response. And that is a pretty powerful reinforcement. So we think that sugar is part of this habit-forming, calming response that we might not even be aware of. We don't need to study acute stress. It's actually part of a chronic habitual pattern for people to feel good. That's what we think is happening, that they're chronically having high sugar to keep their emotional and anxiety and physiological stress arousal toned down. So that's a basic human need.
Thank you. Dr. Tarman, so what is the difference between an eating disorder and food addiction?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, it seems. That was the question that made the food addiction not yet acceptable or recognized in the DSM-5. It is the question that perplexes us at Renaissance, where we have a food addiction program, and we have people coming with binge eating behavior, and how can we tell the difference between one versus the other? Unfortunately, the tools that we use, the eating disorder tools, substance abuse, the DSM-5 criteria, or even the 4 criteria, people will score high on all of them. On the Yale Food Inventory, which unfortunately Ashley's not here, she was going to be, who designed that scale, they'll score high on that too. So what's the difference? It looks the same. And I mean, I can tell you intuitively, I have a sense of what the difference is. But how do we actually tell the difference? Unfortunately, we can tell the difference at the end, did the treatment work or not? And unfortunately, in psychiatry, that's often the way it is. You know, is a person depressed, or are they anxious, or are they bipolar too? It depends on what medication worked, really. So we're kind of stuck with using the solution for the diagnostic criteria. What we try to do from an addiction framework is the food that the behavior around the food, I mean, with this toxic food environment that we're in, and I know we're going to be talking about that over time, that affects every one of us in this room. I mean, if we have a latte, we want a little bit more. So that doesn't mean that we're all food addicts. Where does it make a difference? Where does the line go from wanting to eat, using food for comfort or stress release, to full-blown food addiction, where the person is obsessed about food, to the point where they don't go out at night? All they do is, I get through my day so that I can go home at night with my 2 tubs of Haagen-Dazs and my Netflix. And that's my life. So that's sort of an end-stage picture. So what is the line? How do we determine that? It's basically using the criteria the diagnostic criteria for addiction. Basically, where is the person's attachment to food impairing their normal function? Can they say no because they want to go to see their kid's baseball game? Or are they going to say, no, I'm sorry, I'm so full from my last binge, I can't go out. I feel so bloated. Can they control, I'll just have a few chips or a few cookies or maybe just half a bag. No, they're going to have their 3 bags and then go out and buy more. Can they stop when they have to stop because they've got type 2 diabetes now, not even just type 1 and one pill, but now using insulin, still can't stop. Like we're getting to the point where life is so impaired. Can the person think about anything other than food? Even while I'm talking with you, I'm thinking about what I'm going to eat later and how much I can eat. You know, the obsession. That's what we're looking at when we talk about food addiction.
Thank you. Michael, for you, were there certain trigger foods that started you down the food addiction path?
Well, to answer you specifically, as the question is stated, I don't know. I don't know. But what I can tell you is, first of all, that everything Dr. Tarman just described, I have experienced. I have, you know, quite literally. I worked from 4 to midnight. at a newspaper in Connecticut, and I would leave after work. I would be thinking during work, where am I going to go later? What am I going to get? Am I going to be able to get enough of it? Is it going to be enough of it so I don't have to go out until the morning, et cetera, et cetera? One night when I left particularly unhappy, I pulled off what I call the fast food triple play. You know, they often congregate together, and I drove into McDonald's, went to the drive-thru, ordered a meal, pulled over in the parking lot, and I ate it. Then I went to Burger King next door, and I did the same thing. And I did that not seldomly, but this night I was particularly upset, and so I went to Wendy's. And I did all three, and I'll tell you that by the end, it was kind of hard to finish, but I was committed to it, and I did finish. There are many times when I would go home, I would, maybe not many times, but where literally I would get my food, again, ensuring that I had enough so that I didn't have to go out again. I would pull down the shades, I would unplug the phone, and I would lock the door, even though nobody's coming into my apartment, nobody's trying to look into me. I knew those things, but it didn't matter. I was committed to this. The worst place my disease takes me, and thank goodness it hasn't been for a very long time, is to, I'm laying on the floor in my living room at 3 a.m. I haven't gone to bed yet because I'm thinking that if I just lie there a little bit longer, I might get a little more room so I can eat a little bit more. And I'm lying on the floor because it's too painful to sit up anymore, but I'm still not willing to stop. And the drive to continue very often lasts before the physical room in my body to put more food. And if you want to say, well, that's crazy, yes, it is, and that is a hallmark of addiction. That's why addiction is, in my opinion, is a disease, not a choice. That's crazy behavior, and I repeated it over and over again. Now, trigger foods. This dovetails with some of the things we've already heard discussed up here. I think that's my experience, and I know quite a few other food addicts. My experience is that it's very individual. For example, there are things that I don't eat. Now, I'm not saying these foods are addictive. I'm saying these are things that I don't eat because I can't handle them. And there are things like dried fruit, which is intense sugar, intensified sugar, but also peanuts and popcorn. Tell this brief anecdote, try to make it brief. I went through all sorts of bargaining over the years. I was finding that once they came up with the microwave kind, I'd, you know, buy them two or three three package containers and take them home, and I'd be eating them every night and all that. So I couldn't handle that, so I just said, well, I won't do that anymore. I'll just eat popcorn when I go to the theater, because everybody does that. That's normal, right? Except, one, I knew all the theaters that used real butter instead of the fake stuff. And two, I actually showed up at the Capitol Theater on Mass Ave in Arlington, Mass, without any clue what was playing that night. Because if I went to the theater, then I could have my popcorn with real butter. And I had seen, there was only one movie I was willing to see, and I'd already seen it, and it wasn't that good, but I went in anyway. Okay, I had the same sort of bargaining with peanuts at Fenway Park. You know, what's more American than peanuts at the ballpark? So I lived a mile away, and I went to the game before the tickets became $150. And then, you know, that was a pretty expensive bag of peanuts. Now those are some of the outliers. I can't eat those, mostly because they just haven't made enough to satisfy me, so there's no point in starting. But the specific ones, the ones that are most addictive, or in my experience with being around other people and in my own experience, refined sugar and refined grain, which is known as flour. You know, I'll just tell, this will be the last thing I say. If you think of four plants in nature, the poppy, the coca plant, sugar cane, and wheat, just say those two, because there are obviously more sources for sugar and flour. And in all four, humankind has figured out ways to either mechanically and or chemically split apart the constituents of what came out of the ground, get rid of the fiber, and you intensify what's left into a white or whitish, in the case of heroin, powder. The process is the same. The processing is the same. Now, I'm not saying that sugar and flour are as intense, create as intense a reaction as heroin and cocaine. But then heroin and cocaine don't produce the same intensity of reaction. They're different, but they're on the same continuum. So I'm saying that all four of them, as refined products, have a different effect on the biochemistry of some people than they do on the biochemistry of other people. I mean, two people go into a bar. It's not a joke. Two people go into a bar. One has, they both have the same amount of alcohol, the same kind, the same amount. One goes home and goes to bed. The other ends up in the gutter. What was the difference? It wasn't because alcohol is addictive. It was because of the interaction of the substance and the person's biochemistry. And that's the same in food. That's why I'm affected by sugar and flour. Refined sugar and refined grain is a better way to say that, because I eat sugar. I eat fruit, I eat vegetables, I eat yogurt. They all have sugar. But refined has a different effect on me than it appears to have on other people. And it, you know, whatever anybody else wants to say here in a research term, I'm not a researcher, I'm a journalist. It's real. It's real. I did not make this up. Thank you.
Okay. Now, this next question is real similar to it was just posed to Dr. Tarman, but there's oftentimes subtle differences in the answers to the question, to the same question. So, Dr. Stice, is there a connection between drug use and food addiction? And are food addicts more prone to drug abuse and vice versa? Or drug use and abuse and vice versa?
So if you look at epidemiologic data, there's actually not elevated comorbidity, which is when, you know, like substance use and depression co-occur much higher than you'd expect based on chance. There is comorbidity there, but not with food addiction and drug addiction from what we understand. Other people may have a different experience working with clinic settings where you'll see the people that do have that comorbidity more. But I think it's really important to take a little bit of time to sort of talk about the process by which you become addicted to drugs or food, because it unfolds. And I think there's a lot of things that we can learn from this. But the very first time, and there's a beautiful program of research on kind of the early animal literature, basically, on food reward that looked at this. It's referred to as a Schultz shift because Schultz was the researcher. But the very first time you give a rat a Oreo cookie, which is close to nirvana, apparently, you get this huge release of dopamine. It's you know, very easy to measure with direct measurement of neural signaling. And the more if they consume Oreo cookies on a regular basis, after a couple weeks, what happens is that release of dopamine occurs in response to cues that have been associated with intake of that food, but no longer occurs in response to intake of Oreo cookies. So it goes away. And so what happens is your brain reward regions and your attention regions, because you pay attention to things that you find rewarding, becomes hypervigilant to these cues that have been associated with food. So if you begin a career of eating McDonald's, originally the golden arches mean nothing to you. It looks like any other letter or, you know, it doesn't carry any reward value. But after you eat there all the time, your brain reward circuitry fires off when you see a McDonald's wrapper laying on the gutter, when you see a plastic tray that you've eaten off of at McDonald's hundreds of times, and it's all that reward predictive cue, and that's what drives habitual kind of overeating and, you know, the food addiction, as well as habitual drug use. Unfortunately, like the person who becomes addicted to cocaine will, they basically have to take more and more cocaine to get the same high, which is known as tolerance. Same thing happens with food, as far as we've been able to do research on it. But it's that hyper-responsivity to cues that really causes the craving and causes people to obsess about where they're going to get this food tomorrow or, you know, the next fix. So that process, when you develop it with one substance, whether it's cocaine or Oreos, is very specialized, and that's why you probably see less cross-tolerance or cross-addiction, comorbidity, if you will. So I think it's that sort of reward, you know, being driven by all these cues for reward that really is the crucial part, and that's why there's less overlap, because you go to a certain source for dopamine and you go back to that source. So it's not like you go to, you know, you do all the drugs and overeat. You sort of develop a specialized habit, and that's sort of why I think it's more specialized. But other people may have a totally different thought about comorbidity between food addiction and drug addiction.
Well, I think that they're very similar. There are definitely distinctions, because food, in a way, is like the slow pick-me-upper, and alcohol or cocaine is the fast one. And, you know, when I talk about what are the components of addiction from a clinical point of view, I always say if you get a lot of something that overwhelms our natural pleasure center, as it were, which you will, because it's not, we're not eating an apple, we're eating apple concentrate or apple candy or something like that. That's a potent amount, as you were describing nicely, and also how fast it goes to the brain. So if we actually could smoke sugar, I think that we would be looking at something that's similar to crack. Mm. I mean, cocaine is, we see a lot of functional cocaine addicts. They do a little bit on the weekend, a little bit on the weekend, but then once they introduce crack, well, now it's going to the brain, whoa, fast, and you do it now every 10 minutes because the high only lasts 5 or 10 minutes, so I need another in 5 or 10 minutes. So you're doing it multiple times a day. We're talking about a substance that's now repetitive and a lot and fast. And if we could do the same with sugar, which we do with binge eaters, eat, throw up, eat for, you know, or not. But anyway, food generally takes a little bit longer, but eventually we get there. And so the high, it's potent, but it's not, it looks different because of the actual intake itself. Could I? I'd like to really just jump on something that Michael said about alcohol. That I think is an interesting thing. Alcohol and food. In the Renaissance program, we've introduced the food addiction piece because we've said, look, it's actually not that much different than alcohol. We're just expanding the definition. Alcohol, what is alcohol made of? Primarily sugar, either wine or grain or whatever. And the only thing that makes alcohol different than sugar, besides that potency and I get to drink a lot, is the fermentation. And are we actually getting drunk on the fermented yeast bacterial byproducts, which we believe is what alcohol is, or is it the potency and amount and quickness of the sugar that you're intaking?
That's fascinating.
Yes.
So, Dr. Appel, please explain the reward drive, not necessarily addiction, and how that might be altered.
Well, thanks for asking that. I mostly, rather than studying addiction, more the extreme case of meeting those criteria for addiction, we've been studying more of a common subsyndromal condition that we call, you know, food-related reward drive. And so I'm happy to tell you about what we think we've learned. And actually, one of the main researchers in this, Ashley Maislin, who's here, can you raise your hand? She won't raise her hand, but she has, I'll tell you about her studies on opioid and reward drive a bit later, but the story is simply this. It's not just that we all love sugar and we're either normal eaters or we tip over a threshold and we become food addicts. There is a continuum, and when it's not necessarily taking over our life, it can still take up a big chunk of our life. Mm-hmm. Thinking about food, not feeling satiated, not fully feeling in control. I started off studying emotional eating and stress eating, and that seemed to apply to a certain percentage of people who develop obesity and struggle with emotional eating. But what was common to almost all, to more of people who show up and want help for with overeating is really the thoughts about food and the reward drive. And so I started off having, and many of us here have had long discussions with David Kessler, who wrote a book on this excessive reward drive. He called it hyperconditioned eating syndrome. And so we made up a scale called the reward-based eating drive, the RED. And we've been looking at that in different large samples and small clinical samples. And what we think is that around half of people with obesity suffer from the syndrome. Mm-hmm. So that means they're taking up a lot of their day thinking about food, craving, and feeling not satiated when they finally do get food, but it's not over the threshold where it's actually impairing their life and it meets criteria of addiction. So because this is so common, we've wanted to know, how does this play out in our studies of weight loss? And so we've done several clinical trials of weight loss where we're training people not just in here's the things you need to change. It's not just about eating. It's a much bigger picture about how you are living your day and regulating your emotions and stopping. Really, the problem is stopping once you've started eating. And so we've been using mindfulness training and mindful eating to help with keeping weight off once you lose it. And I can tell you that in our a trial that we recently published on mindful eating for weight loss, we found that it did help a bit with maintaining weight loss, but that wasn't the really big effect. The big effect, as Ashley's uncovered, is that we're reducing the people who are more successful a year later have big reductions in their reward drive. And it's the reward drive that's explaining almost 50% of their longer-term weight loss. So we think that the mindfulness can be helpful, particularly for people with a high reward drive. So obesity is pretty heterogeneous. You might have garden variety, slow overeating and excess calories year by year, but you haven't necessarily been eating excess sugar and you haven't necessarily developed a reward drive. So those people don't necessarily need the mindfulness training, but we think that it particularly helps people with the excessive reward drive.
Okay. So Dr. Tarman, as a clinician, do you agree with Dr. Appel? Will mindful eating help the food addict?
Well, I like the idea of seeing this as a continuum or a spectrum. And I do think that there is a spectrum and that at a certain point a mindfulness process may work. But it's a bit like talking in the addiction realm. Is it possible to have controlled drinking versus not? And I think it's possible for a number of people that it can exist, and in fact it works for a lot of people, but there's at least 10 or 20% of the population genetically predestined, predetermined, or maybe environmental, adverse childhood effects, whatever, where that's not a possibility. And if you just introduce the drug, it produces what we call a phenomenon of craving. The hypersensitivity of the dopamine response will just flare. It's like it's kindled in such a way that I don't know if mindfulness would be enough to combat that. It might mitigate it. I like to think of it as it might support like a willpower response. And I usually think instruct my patients to say willpower is like an EpiPen. It'll buy you 20 minutes to get to the hospital to get to safety. It will not in and of itself cure the problem because the flare-up, the allergy will come back again in 20 minutes or half an hour. So if you've reached beyond a certain point, I don't think it will work, but it's a question of where you are on that spectrum. And that I think that spectrum is something we really need to clinically understand more about.
Okay. Dr. Lustig, is sugar a food?
It's a very good question. I'm going to riff a little bit on what Michael talked about. You know, we have things that change their properties when you purify them, all right? So like you said, coca leaves is a medicinal. Cocaine is a drug. Opium is a medicinal. Morphine or heroin is a drug. So the question is, what happens when you purify sugarcane? And does that change its properties in such a way that it could, instead of being a food, could be a drug? Now, one of the reasons that we have this discussion, one of the reasons you're sitting here in the audience today, is because this is controversial. This whole concept of food addiction is controversial. We have colleagues in the scientific field who say, how can you have food addiction? Food is necessary for survival. Mm-hmm. That basically mitigates the concept of food addiction. What we have is not food addiction. What we have is eating addiction. And there are several papers where this is said. I would caution you about that because you have to look at who is writing the papers. And if you look at the people who are writing the papers on this concept of eating addiction, they are taking money from the food industry.
So that's terrible.
That is, but it's the truth, nonetheless. So what we need to answer is the question of, is sugar a food? Because if it's not a food, then we get away from this concept of, well, it's necessary for survival. We can basically take it out of that rubric that has sort of held this field back. So I'm going to ask you a question now. Okay, what's the definition of food? I have it right here. It's on my iPad. Okay, and I opened it up very specifically because I knew this question was coming. So it depends on who you ask. So I'm going to read you the definitions. So the Food and Drug Administration, in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act of 1938, section 321.201, subsection F, says, the term food means, one, articles used for food or drink or man or for man and other animals. Now, the first rule of vocabulary is you can't define a word with the word. This is a piece of crap, okay? And we've been using it for the past, 1938, so we're coming up on 80 years, okay? It's garbage. So let's move on. Let's move to Webster's. Webster's says, food is a material consisting essentially of protein, carbohydrate, and fat used in the body of an organism to sustain growth, repair, and vital processes, and to furnish energy. Well, by that definition, sugar would be a food because it certainly furnishes energy. It's got calories. And if it's got calories, it's furnishing energy. So that should be the end of the discussion. So our opponents on the other side who say, well, food is necessary for survival, they would be right, wouldn't they? Okay, so here's the argument. Can you name me an energy source that is not food, that is not nutrition, that there's no biochemical reaction in the body that requires it, that when consumed in excess causes cell, organ system, human damage, and death, and we love it anyway and it's addictive? Alcohol, thank you. Alcohol. Alcohol is calories. Alcohol furnishes energy. Alcohol is not a food. Alcohol is a chronic dose-dependent hepatotoxin.
Yes.
Alcohol is toxic and abused. Toxic and abused. We keep it out of the hands of children very specifically because it is toxic and abused. Now, there are many substances that we are exposed to that in high dose can be toxic, like, for instance, iron or oxygen or water or vitamin D, but they have no abuse potential. Conversely, we have substances in our lexicon that are clearly abusive and addictive, but they have no downside toxic side effect, like, for instance, caffeine, until you mix it with alcohol and then you get Four Loko, which is banned. The point is, you can be toxic and not abused, or you can be abused and not toxic, and you have no problem. And we can peacefully coexist with all of those compounds. But what if you're both toxic and abused? Alcohol certainly fits that criteria, and we regulate it, even though it has calories, even though it supplies energy. So you know what? Webster's got it wrong, too. So there is no actual definition of food that makes sense. So the question is sugar a food? Well, sugar cane might be, but refined sugar, it's just like heroin or morphine or cocaine. After you purify it, it changes its properties. It does all of the things that Dr. Stice and Dr. Eppel already told you about in terms of the reward system, in terms of downregulation of dopamine receptors, in terms of the pathway to addiction, and it's not food. It's a food additive, just like caffeine. And when it was a food additive, that is, prior to the advent of processed food, where you basically got your sugar out of 5-pound bags and you knew how many teaspoons you were adding to your coffee or your tea, we didn't have this problem because you were in control of it. But now, since the advent of processed food in 1965, they're in control of it, and we are all overdosed. So the question is sugar a food? The thing that makes sugar a food is its presence on a list at the FDA, and that list is called GRAS, G-R-A-S, generally recognized as safe. Now, in 1958, when this GRAS list was started, there were 158 items on the GRAS list. Today, there are 10,000. Now, do you really think there are 10,000 items that you can put in your body at any dose that won't hurt you? Really? Well, it turns out in 1997, the FDA farmed GRAS out to the industry. So the only thing that it takes for an item to go on the GRAS list today is for a company to convene a group of experts to sit in a room and say, oh yeah, that substance is GRAS. And then it's GRAS. It's just that simple. There, of those 10,000 substances, the FDA doesn't even know about 1,000 of them because they don't have to report it. They just put it on. So the question is sugar supposed to be on the GRAS list? Well, one of the definitions of GRAS is in doses commonly intended. The doses that we consume today of sugar were not commonly intended. So it actually doesn't meet the criteria for GRAS today. So this is the question. The question is, does sugar belong on the GRAS list? Because as long as it's on the GRAS list, we will have two problems. Number one, the food industry will continue to use as much as it wants in any food it likes. And number two, we will continue to have scientists who will say, well, sugar is energy and therefore it is needed for survival. Sugar is not a food. Sugar is a food additive. And we take food additives off the GRAS list when they are shown to be toxic. For instance, alcohol, trans fats, nitrates are all off the GRAS list because they are all not safe in doses commonly used. Neither is sugar. So I would argue that sugar is not a food. And when you realize that sugar is not a food, basically the road to fixing this problem becomes very clear.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dr. Avina, is it possible for a pregnant woman to pass along a propensity for food addiction to her child?
So this is something that myself and some other scientists are beginning to wonder about. We've known for many years that it's possible to pass along a drug addiction to a child, either via genetics or simply via exposure. We've all are familiar with the term crack babies, where, you know, babies that are born to women who are addicted to drugs, are they themselves addicted once they are born? And so the question has become, well, might we also see this with food? There's been lots of research going on looking at the effects that highly palatable foods can have on brain reward systems and some of these behaviors that are associated with addiction in adult animals. But what about in babies? What about in utero? And what does the whole process of pregnancy have to do with this? And so I can tell you that the recent research that has come out that has looked at this, and again, a lot of this has been conducted in animal models because we can really control those variables, has shown that if you have an animal that is fed a high sugar diet, a diet that is rich in high fructose corn syrup or sucrose, and then look at the babies when they grow up, we see lots of different things happening. One, those babies who, again, have never tasted high fructose corn syrup or sucrose, they've simply just been exposed to it in the womb, those babies grow up to prefer sweet taste. They also have a heightened propensity to use drugs such as amphetamine. They're more sensitive to the effects of amphetamine, and they're more likely to drink alcohol. And so what this suggests, and scientists are now beginning to look at this, is by being exposed to these types of highly palatable foods, excess amounts of these highly palatable foods in utero, it actually can affect the DNA methylation, the development of what's happening in the brain during this critical time, such that now that these babies, when they grow up, they are prone to potentially overeat or potentially use drugs.
So I think that this is really a critical area, and I think that we're seeing the field go in the direction of really trying to understand what is happening during pregnancy and what are the effects that can happen in utero and long-term to the offspring. You know, as I'm a mom myself, I have two young kids, and I can say that there's quite a bit of information out there for pregnant women about what foods to avoid. You know, don't eat deli meats and don't eat raw hot dogs, and, you know, there's lots of concern about toxicity. But there's really no guidance for women in terms of what you should eat to ensure a healthy diet other than just eat healthy food. And I think this is important because the average woman entering a pregnancy is overweight or obese. That's a fact. Mm-hmm. And so we're facing a population of people who are pregnant who are having a problem regulating their body weight to begin with and are potentially needing some assistance with making better food choices. So the long-term effects of what women eat during pregnancy, it does appear, can have effects down the road for the offspring.
So I just want to ask you, so would it be fair to say then that based on what you're saying, that we are creating food addicts with the diet that our pregnant women are eating, essentially creating people like Michael?
More up.
I think that we are setting the stage for more individuals to be at risk for developing problematic eating behaviors and problems with reward-mediated behaviors later on. And I think, again, this is going to not simply, it's not just because women are eating the wrong foods during pregnancy. It's a combination of that environment and also the genetic propensity that might be there independent of what the women eat during pregnancy. So I think that we are contributing to the problem in some sense, but I don't want to say that that's a singular cause of it.
Yeah. Let me just add, people are talking about what you're eating during pregnancy. It's also what the lactating mother provides the baby. Mm-hmm. So it's always been said that breast milk is the world's best food, and breastfeeding actually prevents childhood obesity later. But you know what? Mm-hmm. The data that supports that is actually very old. And the new data that's been coming out has shown that that has muddied quite a bit. So if looking at the data on breastfeeding promoting, preventing obesity, it's not nearly as clean. In fact, it almost looks like it's gone away. So the question I would pose to all of you is, does sugar cross into breast milk? And the answer is, oh, yeah, big time. So that mother drinking a Coke while she's lactating, who's getting that? Okay, that's number one. Number two, the whole question about what crosses the placenta. So it was always said that fructose, the sweet molecule in sugar, did not cross the placenta because the placenta does not have the GLUT5 transporter, which is specific for fructose. So for decades, we were told this is not a problem. Turns out the placenta has more GLUT8 transporters than it has GLUT5 transporters, which is eminently good at transporting fructose. We just were looking for the wrong thing. So it's very likely that we are setting kids up, babies up, fetuses up, before they ever come out. So people are always talking about, well, we've got to do something about childhood obesity. Well, you know what? If in order to fix childhood obesity, we've got to fix infant obesity. Well, in order to fix infant obesity, we've got to fix fetal obesity. And in order to fix fetal obesity, we have to fix mother's obesity before she ever became pregnant. Well, guess what? Now that's everyone.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we have quite a few more questions, but I think the next few will go longer than 1:30. So I think we'll stop and take a break right here.